"My perfect mind" is a quotation from King Lear. The line is uttered by the king when he fears he is not in that state. It has a personal relevance for Edward Petherbridge, who was in rehearsals for King Lear in New Zealand in 2007 when he suffered a stroke, and that experience provides the basis for a show co-produced by the Drum Theatre Plymouth, The Company Told by an Idiot, and the Young Vic, where it's playing now for an extended run. The show is directed by Catherine Hunter, and it's performed by Edward Petherbridge with Paul Hunter, and it was written by all three of them. Well, Edward Petherbridge and Paul Hunter are with me, Heather Neal, now in the Young Vic Theatre to talk about the show. So welcome to Theatre Voice. Well, let's go back, first of all, to that experience. You were in New Zealand and you just started rehearsals, but you'd already learned the part, is that right?
Yes, I didn't want to leave anything to chance because as you get older, you don't learn things so quickly. And think of the madness that would really ensue if you arrived on day one and thought, well, I'll rehearse and I'll go home and start to learn it. A bit late, really, isn't it? So, bearing in mind it's a very big part, long part, complex language. So I'd been doing other stuff. Those were the days when I used to do other stuff. Midsummer Murders and a tour of an Alan Bennett play, and that was what I was doing chiefly. And betwixt and between all that, I was finding time to sit in my garden or on my digs on tour, parrot learning King Lear, which I refer to in the show as a chore. However transcendental the lines are, it's a chore that you have to. It's a wonderful way of studying a part, of course. Mm. Having to go over and over and over and over and over until you know it. Some people are blessed with photographic memories, but I'm not. There is a myth that I knew every line of it after the stroke, which happened on after the second day of rehearsal. That may be true, but that's 6 years ago, and so I had to basically refamiliarize myself with the great cadences in case we needed any of them in this show.
And indeed you do.
Well, Paul will bear me out in this. We had a sort of war of attrition, really, in a kind of friendly way. I was trying to shoehorn as much King Lear as I could, and he was trying to subvert that process. Because what he was doing was, it was Catherine Hunter who decided that, having got hold of my autobiographical sort of theatre book, which is meant to be a study of the theatre, turns out to be a study of me, apparently. She rather liked all that autobiographical stuff, and I was very wary about putting it into the show. But between the three of us, and particularly with Paul shaking up a kind of the shards of my life in a kind of kaleidoscope, and they would occasionally settle in a crazy pattern, and so I was complicit in this somewhat magical mystery tour come sort of pantomime or...
Well, yes, we ought to say that it is...
It's a comedy.
It's many things, but one of the things it is being that it's very funny.
As we sit here with this table... has a piece of Hessian which is splattered with paint, and that happened last night in the show, so you can see it's... it's all fire and music and water and...
Paul, you're accused of subverting Edward's King Lear. But in fact, the shape of the show must have quite a lot to do with you. You're well known for your comedy, Told by an Idiot, and elsewhere, like at the Globe, for instance.
I suppose I've always been fascinated by comedy as a performer or director or whatever, and I think my main interest lies always in trying to clash it with something else or to mix it very closely with something else. And I suppose we just had a hunch that with what happened to Edward as a starting point and obviously King Lear, there was the opportunity to really find a fusion between comedy and something more poignant and more fragile. Mm. And of course, you never know. I mean, if someone had said to me that you're going to make a show based on the notion of a rather celebrated older actor having a stroke and not playing King Lear, and this would be something that would appeal to a wide range of people, I'm not sure I would have believed it. But that's the joy of theatre.
Except that's what you came up with as a notion.
Yes, no, I did.
I was the one who said, I'm not sure that'll work.
No, I did believe it in an idea. I absolutely believed in it. I suppose what's been wonderful is the surprise of just how many people have seemed to have connected to the piece on lots of different levels. Mm. That's what's been very joyous.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if we can give some idea of what happens in it. you begin with as a sort of cod psychiatrist in an extraordinary wig and a German accent, claiming that Mr. Petherbridge is actually King Lear.
Yes, I mean, I can't. I mean, Edward would, I'm sure, back this up. When we make the show in rehearsal with Catherine, I no longer have memories of why certain improvisations are stuck or arose. Mm. And I think that's a good thing, because we improvised so much. And I think it was one of the reasons why I'm convinced the show has turned out the way it is, because it was a very collaborative room. And it didn't matter where the idea came from. It just came from a group of us, you know, responding to material and trying things. But this notion, it felt like an extreme thing to start, which was a good thing, is the notion that even though Edward wasn't, it was quite nice to start from the premise of someone was so obsessed with this notion that we could set up the idea that actually he was King Lear whilst pretending to be Edward Petherbridge. And then luckily that seemed to have some mileage in it. And then I suppose what we quite liked about the idea of that was that we could commit to something and take the audience into King Lear, the dividing of the kingdom. And then just as we get into that, and just as Edward gets into that, and the audience do, we pull the rug and go, I'm not sure we should do that, or start the show like that. So it allowed us to set up this notion that throughout the show we were continually going to subvert or pull the rug from the audience in terms of where we were, what was happening. So it's sort of happening to Edward, but at the same time it's happening to the audience.
Yes. Sorry, Edward.
I think a lot of it came from... I think the show adds a great deal to a very stuffed outtake bin that we might, metaphorically have in that rehearsal room in the town hall at Shoreditch, which we might go and rummage through one day. Because we went through so many at Catherine Hunter's behest often, she would set us little ideas sketched on a piece of paper that we would perhaps be given secretly or something. But in fact, I think our working method really, really... I don't know about Told by an Idiot, because this is the first show up there as I've seen.
Close-up view.
Which just shows how sequestered my life in the theatre has been. But... excuse me. As far as our relationship is concerned, a lot of it dates back to the relationship we struck up with such ease in this failed production of The Fantastics, this kind of off-Broadway phenomenon that's a musical which ran for 50 years.
So that's where
we didn't quite make 4 weeks in the West End. And we met doing this kind of faded tatterdemalion King Lear figure with his sidekick, who were hired as a sort of last-ditch attempt to inject a sort of drama into the lovers. It's a very fantastical. Anyway, that's what
they're... First half's not bad.
But they're very good.
The second half.
The second, my son said, The second half. I thought I must be on drugs. Anyway.
And, so has he been to see this? Because then he'll be sure he's on drugs.
Well, by the same token, I do say that this is rather like attending a masterclass in King Lear under the influence of LSD. And I don't know much about that, but we did hear on the World Service from the man who first took out LSD the other week. And he described it very much as a show that could look like this. Possibly a little more colour in
the
palette.
So you met on that. Did you decide and to do it while you were doing it?
Well, I floated the idea of us doing a sort of two-man King Lear at the... I think I did.
Yes, you did.
At the Edinburgh Festival or something. And he said... I think, Paul, you said, I think there might be a show to be done about you not doing King Lear. And that was the first conversation, and pithy as it was. Anyway, we met at various hostelries and tea places.
And how long did all this take, the preparation?
We kept on thinking we might have a date, and then we didn't.
We did the Fantastics 3 years ago. It was this time 3 years ago. And from that time, we kept talking and meeting. And because, obviously, of having the company up, I couldn't guarantee to Edward that the show would be any good. But I sort of felt with the idea, and obviously Edward's reputation as an actor, I sort of felt I could guarantee that we could get it on.
Yeah.
I said to Edward, I can't guarantee whether it'll be any good or not, but I can guarantee we could make this happen.
Yeah.
And by the time, even just early conversations, by the time I was talking to David Lann at the Young Vic over a cup of coffee, and the idea immediately appealed to him. And I was very honest with him. I said, it's nothing more than an idea at the moment.
Yeah.
So I'm asking you to invest in something crazy.
But David's quite good at seeing
an extraordinary nose, I think, for the idea of something.
Yeah.
And it felt like this place was the right venue for it somehow, the audience here and the sort of stuff that David does.
You mentioned the audience already, and the way the audience plays with you is quite extraordinary, really.
They are. Of course, I always think that when you're rehearsing, even in an empty rehearsal room, with only the ASM and the prompter and the director, you're imagining an audience.
Mm-hmm.
Aren't you?
Mm, yeah, the whole time.
And then suddenly you meet them and they turn out not to be what you imagine at all.
I suppose they're different every time as well.
Yes, they are. And when we met our first audience in Plymouth, it was rather wonderful and liberating because they are proactive. Anyway, they are proactive. But in this, the way they recognise the turning points where they were... we're not meant to have been here, and now we are here. That sort of thing, you know.
Yes, and the changes of mood, they're almost acting a part themselves.
Mm, yes. They're acting people who aren't really there, and then they're complicit.
Yes.
Well, I think it makes the whole experience very present, whereas I think sometimes theatre can feel not very present. I mean, it's not totally alive.
Well, you managed to give the impression that... You know, it could be different on another night. We're partly making it up for you.
That's true. I mean, I don't think we necessarily set out to do that, but I think as we started to write it, we stumbled on a form which is very fluid. It's a very tight...
Of course, literally write it.
No. Writing is maybe not the right way of expressing it.
I did ask for a script.
Edward and I have... Apparently there is one, which the lighting people and sound people use, but Edward and I have never seen one. We don't look at one. It's...
How amazing. You have never had it written down at all. No. For your purposes.
People used to... I've experienced this in... I've just remembered a live television play I was in once, a series, and it was all I had written on a topical thing. The famous guy who did Nicholas Nickleby wrote to ours.
David Edgar?
David Edgar. And we had to do something that was very topical. And do it live in 4 days or something.
Oh, yes.
It was an experiment, and every day we'd be rehearsing, and
you'd see them towards the end of the day, they would be bringing in the sides, as we call them, the paper, the next edition. So we thought, well, why the fuck are we rehearsing this when they're bringing that? And it happened every day.
Oh,
and so God. You had to go home and...
So this is a doddle, obviously.
But this we were released from script because although they transcribed it dutifully, I couldn't bring myself to... Because I thought, well, I didn't say that, did I? I should have been better than that. And we kept it fresh and... in fact, Paul's been rather more... because I was so busy trying to learn and say... chunks of King Lear, which there are a bit of. I was rather sort of keen on that. And Paul is a little bit more faithful to his own inventions than I always managed to
be. But I also think that's partly, again, we stumbled on this, but I think that's partly the notion of a sort of double act, which is what I enjoy. I mean, we didn't talk about it in those terms, but in any good double act, people have different functions. And I think, for me, it's very satisfying that we have as a psychototype structure, and part of my function, whether it be a German doctor or a Romanian cleaner or Laurence Olivier, is to provide a structure which gives freedom to Edward, not exclusively, but moments or times where... And I think that allows the audience to both feel secure and quite excited when it suddenly goes somewhere else. If we were both doing that the whole time, I think it would be too anarchic.
And a friend of mine said that... as I seem to sort of vaguely sort of wander through this play, Paul Hunter's fool, as it were, is rushing around with glue trying to keep the things stuck together, you know.
Yes, well, the double act, King Lear and the Fool. I mean, there's certainly some of that in it, isn't there?
I mean, I'm very grateful for the structure and I think, for example... There is a rather, without giving too much away, which one doesn't want to do, for people who haven't seen it, there's a rather quiet bit where not as much is said, and then a chunk of Lear is done, which is very, very mysterious and still and slow. And it happens just before the storm. And then... immediately after the storm, there is a very tight little comic interlude which comes from somewhere quite different. Mm. Suddenly in the Bridlington Spa Pavilion, you know, in a talent contest. And as I don't think I used to know quite when I was doing the show. I knew the bit that I was in, but I thought I had no idea which bit was coming next. And one line leads to another, and you said, oh, you're doing this bit now. But now I can sort of understand the landscape of the show.
Well, is King Lear forms the structure of it, doesn't it?
I'm very pleased though, because people kept saying, I don't know who they were, but they would say, you know, are you drawing a parallel between your experience and King Lear's? And that would have been too grandiose for words, you know. Mm. I wouldn't equate anything that happened to me with what happened to King Lear. Except insofar as when one does any part, one tries to make the character's experience one's own. And that's the only way you can relate to it. What would it be if I was thrown out on a heath in the storm?
Well, we ought to say something about your actual experience and some of the jokes which some of us are old enough to remember the origins of, such as things that happened in Olivier's National Theatre, where you were the first Guildenstern, were you not? And you were in the role Hunt of the Sun, and you can still sing the incantation.
Yes, it's extraordinary. It stayed with me. I was the lead singer in the... it was my...
I have to say, I can sing it too.
Oh, can you really? Yes. Why can you sing it?
Because I was an usher at the time.
Anyway. We could do it together.
Maybe I'll.
Well, yes. Do I leave a... I have a feeling... I have an LP of it, and of various bits of music from those days, and I have some technical reasons I can't play it at the moment. And I'm wondering if there is a line I leave out of it. Could you?
I'm not sure that I can be as accurate as that.
You weren't the usherette who... Usherette, one could say Usherette in
those
days.
Yeah.
We were doing Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead one night, and it starts off with this endless flicking of coins, heads. And there are however many heads there are, an awful lot of coins between me and John Stride. And then suddenly, partway through this routine, there was an usherette in the gods who dropped her change bag, and the coins went... and somebody up in the gods said, heads. And, of course, it was kind of told by an idiot
territory. Yeah, no, really. No, I can imagine.
Well, we've come into your autobiography now. Was that difficult for you, Paul, to negotiate your way around Edward's memories? At what moment?
I mean, when it became, I suppose, clear that I was going to play a variety of things, from Edward's mother to Laurence Olivier, and that sort of...
Yes. It also Edward's mother had a stroke just before you were born.
Extraordinary. I mean, I think what was amazing theatrically about that for us, and Catherine leapt on it, which I think was very good, is... And this is what I mean, I suppose, about my fascination between comedy and it being clashed very closely with something else. Mm-hmm. Once that was revealed, that had happened, it gave us, a really interesting way into what happened to Edward. Mm-hmm. It enabled us theatrically to avoid the things that Edward was worried about and I was worried about, i.e. sentiment and this, you know...
We didn't want it to be documentary.
No.
And we didn't want to be asking for sympathy or anything particularly psychologically piercing, did we?
And I think those things...
And yet I don't know quite what territory we thought we were in.
No, exactly.
It was a sort of storybook telling.
Yes, and the notion that our designer, Michael Vail, was also a crucial part of the collaboration.
Yes.
Because as I started to become these different figures, your instinct sometimes as an actor is to put more things on, and I'll dress up, of course. Mm. And actually what Michael was very good at was going, no, we should trust the simplicity of it and allow the audience to imagine more. So what we ended up with was something very pared back. So when I play Edward's mum, it's just a hairnet. When I play the Romanian cleaner, it's a pair of rubber gloves. And the style emerged there, which is much more theatrically interesting, allowing the audience to imagine more. But, of course, I can't. It's ludicrous, if you think about it, that I'm going to play his mother and Olivier. But... it taps into a sort of theatrical truth, which in a way is more interesting than the fact, you know, I'm stood there in my blue tracksuit with a hairnet. I'm still committing with every part of me to being his mother.
Yeah, it's very important that, because we've all been in productions, and you've probably done productions, where you're in the rehearsal room and you don't have very much, and then you hit the set and all the paraphernalia, and it can be thrilling, or it can be, oh, we've lost... a simplicity and innocence. Yeah. I remember when I was doing one of the versions of one of the editions, as it were, of Peter Pan that Trevor Nunn did with a boy playing Peter Pan for the first time. We were left to our own devices, just the cast, in the below sea level, I think, in the Barbican. There's a terrible fluorescent lit concrete room.
I know that room. Yeah.
Terrible.
A bunker.
I think they use it for storing old programmes now.
Or interrogating people, isn't it?
And we were left to our own devices with nothing. Everything, every prop had been taken away to do Peter Pan in this unhappy, unhealthy environment. And I was playing the storyteller, reading the stage directions, basically. But anyway, long story to no avail, which you can edit out. But the point of the story is... that I've just told that you won't be hearing on the transcript, is that it was the most magical performance of Peter Pan that one could ever hope to see. About childhood and make-believe and magic, and it was all created there. And if somebody had told me that at any stage in my life, particularly when I was a boy or an actor, that you will become a time in your life when you'll meet another actor who will be younger than you and shorter than you, and he will play your mother. And Laurence Olivier, who you will have an intimate relationship with, we didn't, of course. Although, you know, I acted with him and had dinner with him. And, of course... Paul is not like either of them. Mm. Not even faintly. Except that he is. Except that he is. Okay. And I believe in it.
Yes. Well, you talked about the simplicity, and we should mention the set, because that does give us your world when you begin. And it's sort of tip-tilted and out of kilter. And
well, it's sort of interesting, because we Michael Vale, who designed it, and I think it is quite an inspired idea, that the notion that the world that we are on, as you say, out of kilter is exactly the right thing, a sloping, a very steep rake, not going in the conventional sense towards the audience, but to the side, a trap door that we open quite early on and leave open as this gaping, rather dangerous hole.
Yes, that is really worrying.
Which we like.
Some people aren't worried by it, some of them are.
In a sense, of course, it becomes a metaphor for what happened to Edward, which is really exciting. But also, because we had it in rehearsal the whole time, we kind of wrote the show on it. It allowed us to find language which we would never have found if we hadn't had them.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that we opened... The only reason the trap, in a sense, stays open is that when I opened it, I couldn't quite figure out how you closed it. So I remember saying in rehearsal, I can't quite work out how you close this thing. And then suddenly someone went, well, let's just leave it open for a bit. And then as it stayed open, it became this. And then, of course, it becomes something that we return to at the end when Olivier, without giving too much away, is with Edward. And we both look down this hole and we talk about what might be down there. And you only find those things, I think, if you can't plan those things. They arrive because
we didn't actually plan.
No, we didn't plan anything.
Anything, no. Really. Mm. I mean, not really. I suppose... Catherine did set a certain...
She provoked us.
We played on this rake, and we pretended it was a mountain and whether we were going up it or down it. And one of the games was... I mean, I hate theatre games, beanbags and all that crap. But improvisation, when you have to make up the lines of Shakespeare, all that rubbish. But these games were wonderful, and the wonderful game was Where Are We Now, for example. Somebody might throw that in at any moment, and the other person would say, and then we had to do a riff, a make-believe riff on that. Mm. It might be a place in my book, or it might be a place in a theatre, or King Lear, or whatever. Mm. And... We found when we were in the Fantastics on a rake, actually, which is probably where the idea came from, actually, going in the conventional way down to the audience. We found working together, even on a script and in a rather tight show, that we didn't have to make suggestions to one another necessarily. We just did things and responded to one another kind of. So that our relationship, which is rather nebulous in the script, to say the least, was kind of I don't know whether osmotic is the word, but it was an osmosis that of collaboration that happened, and which we knew we could rely on, which is partly to do with trust and not being in, and the idea of, because I was worried, you see, that this little part might be a thorn in my actor's flesh, trying to play this old actor with this rather nebulous part. I thought, what's he going to do while I'm doing my, what's he going to do? Is he going to look in the wrong direction or distract? But in fact, the more we were drawn into it together, the more creative it became. And so it was... It was rather a magical relationship, which I knew we could rely on. Mm. And it wasn't rivalry.
Have you arrived at a version which changes a little bit?
We've arrived at the structure of the show is now feels really sound, and we, you know, we've played it.
And
over,
you know how long it's going to take.
Yeah, we've played it over 40 times now in various places around the country.
Yes. I mean, the fact that it looks... as if we're making up as we go along, if it does, is an illusion.
Yes. Well,
I put in a little riff for Shakespeare's birthday the day before yesterday.
Oh, that's good.
Just a minute or two. Yeah.
And also, I think there's always a... I suppose, like Edward was saying about the playing relationship, that sense... even though it might appear very sort of nebulous, it's actually a very, very strong thing, which you don't often find. And again, we did one rehearsal one Saturday morning down the road here for the Fantastics. Never worked together, didn't know each other. And it was in an hour of playing in this rehearsal that when we came out, I remember going home to my wife going, oh, that's the most fantastic rehearsal. That you, it's actually stronger than anything that's connected to the text. Or it goes much deeper than that. It's something which... And I passionately believe it's something that an audience really connects to. Amongst the bedrock of the show is me and Edward.
Yes.
That's part what it is about. Mm. It's not just about King Lear and what happened to Edward. It's about two men, one older, one late middle age, trying to do something.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the humanity comes from. It's two people trying and supporting each other. And you know, you look at Laurel and Hardy, Stan, he's never deliberately trying to mess Ollie up. He's trying to help put the piano up the steps, but because of who he is, it will go wrong. But their sense of being stuck together takes you to Beckett, Shakespeare, all of the things that are quite fundamental in what we see.
And yet, on the other hand, it's almost, dare I say, dangerous for us to anatomize this.
Yeah.
Because, as somebody famously said in The Apology Being Asked, innocence is a delicate, exotic fruit, touch it and the bloom is gone. And I think that's right.
Yeah.
Well, it's better that we don't read too many of our good notes.
Yeah. No, we don't do that.
Well, it is very theatrical, but it's also sending up theatre and sending up acting all the time, and that's one way in which you're making the audience complicit.
Yes, because of course, one could get very highfalutin about this, but there's a little bit where if I was Tom Stoppard, I'd have written a brilliant script for myself, and I sometimes wish I were. It's just that we do, because we touch on things that might crop up in Arcadia, the play, I mean, and you know, to do with truth, for example, in the theatre and all that sort of thing, and when could hone a rather marvellous line. But perhaps, and here I'm going against my own wisdoms, trying to anatomize, perhaps in glancing against these big concepts while we're actually doing the plumbing of the show, the magic of the highfalutin image, the water flowing and being alive, is kind of a mystery that is not too laid out like a perfect poem, but is there nevertheless somehow as a piece of craftsmanship.
Yeah,
I don't know with that.
No, I think the audience goes.
Now,
having
said that, of course, I should immediately disclaim it.
Refute the whole thing.
It's kind of what the show does, isn't it?
Yeah, yes. But I think the audience is sort of doing the same thing. They know we have been on a journey which is profound in a way, but we're not going to plumb it too much because we've had a good time.
Yeah. It should be, you know, like I personally feel when you're dealing with any of those things, it should always be done lightly, with a light touch.
Yeah. Our script, she's called our script editor, I think, is our advisor, consultant. Kathleen Riley, who also happened to edit my book, heard a piece of Vox Pop as she was leaving the theatre the other night. A lady said, "Well, I don't know what that was. I really don't know. But it was brilliant." and that's... We quite like that.
Yeah, no, I think that's it, really, isn't it? Just before we finish, has doing this reveal anything more about King Lear to both of you, actually? Or is that just beside the point, really?
I don't know. I mean, Edward, I'm sure, would be able to talk more deeply about this, but, you know, I've often, as an actor, thought, oh, it's a role that the fool is a role I'd like to play. And Edward, I remember saying this in rehearsal way before this, we were chatting breaks in the Fantastics, and I think they were casting it somewhere, and I was talking about it. And Edward sort of said, wisely said, well, be careful what you wish for. He said, because you could often be in a thing where you've got very little freedom and very little, you know, Leah's on you like a, you know, iron glove. And I sort of feel in a way, and a good friend of mine who's played the fool came to see it the other night and said, he said he loved it, he said, but he was very envious of the fact that I sort of got to do the fool without having to do these terrible old jokes that no one gets or laughs at. He said, I've had to do all of that, and then you get to do the fool kind of doing much more interesting material instead. So I feel in a sense, if I've got anything from it, playing moments of Lear opposite Edward has been extraordinary for me as an actor, and being directed by Catherine in it, I feel like I've learned huge amounts from that.
Being able to play Cordelia.
Absolutely. I mean, who's going to cast me as that? So it's a nice chance. But I also feel, in a sense, I've got to play the fool, which is rather lovely. But I don't know, Edward, but I'm sure I have more.
What about you? I mean, it must have been a disappointment, although having come through the awfulness of the stroke, you must have been more glad to be alive than worried about not having played King Lear.
Oh, yes. The brain damage that you get, apparently, when I heard this on the radio, when I was in hospital through earphones. The radio kept me alive when I couldn't read, write, walk, or anything. And I heard that the synapses that generate regret are often disabled by a stroke.
Oh.
So that was why I was able to concentrate on getting better rather than grieving about not doing Lear.
Yeah.
I was on a completely different landscape. But having got to do it, bits of it, there's not much I can say about it, really, because I haven't really done it. I've done bits of, gems from, as we used to say. But there's a marvellous something that Vivian Leigh wrote in a letter, which I read the other day, about doing Shakespeare. She was doing Shaw's Antony... Season Cleopatra, and Shakespeare's Antony and Cleopatra in tandem. They were doing it, she and Livia, together. And I'm going to paraphrase her, but she said, with Shaw, you get in the train and you sit there and you arrive. Whereas with Shakespeare, it's like swimming in the sea. You can go anywhere. Now, of course, when one thinks of Peter Hall being very strict, I've never worked with him, luckily, on Shakespeare. Should I rephrase that? But anyway, I know that he's very strict about meter and stress and all that. And, of course, that's very important, and the music of it. But it's amazing, the emotional license. I don't know whether that's the right word, but if you are in a show like this where you're not responsible to a director and a cast that has landed on a concept for Lear, I have the thing of approaching these edifices of these golden speeches night by night, and they are... You never get to the bottom of them. And if you... Am I running out of... you can edit this down. I asked an actor who'd played with Sir Donald Woolfitt, King Lear. He was in Tattyrep. We were both in Tattyrep. And he said, I acted with Woolfitt. Oh, good God. I was in Lear. He was playing the Ninth Gentleman or something. And he said... I said, what was he like? He said, well, it was all right as long as he didn't sing. As long as he didn't decide to sing. Which I suppose he knew what, he had a sort of trajectory over which he vocally did the part. And you can imagine that, especially then. And one afternoon they were doing a matinee, and somebody called out from the gods, come on, Donald, come on, let's be having you. Well, I can hear Shakespeare saying that to me. In a way, go on, carry on. Go on, see if you can do it.
I think that's a good place to start, don't you?
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to Edward and Paul.